Roswell's 62nd anniversary, and we've been here. This makes our 6 year, as a matter of fact. We're here at the convention center. Invited to come by and watch the proceedings, ask questions of the guest or whatever. Nick Pope flew in from England, and actually you only had one stop, huh, in Dallas?
Yes, it was a pretty good journey. Living in London, it's very easy, really, because you can get just about anywhere from Heathrow. So I went Heathrow to Dallas, Dallas to Albuquerque. But it's still, of course, a three-mile drive through the desert from Albuquerque down here to Roswell.
This is the first time for you?
Yes, this is my first time in Roswell, which is, I think a lot of people are quite surprised by that because they say, but Nick, you've been involved in this subject for years and you've never been. And I say, no, I've never been. So I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to come to a place which is so linked to this subject. Indeed, it's almost synonymous with this subject.
You came in, what, Wednesday?
I came in.
Tuesday or Wednesday?
Oh, I just flew in. Well, now, hang on, let me see. It was just yesterday evening.
We just started, and it seems like it was last week.
No, no, I got in, by the time I got into the hotel, it was about 11:15 on Wednesday night.
The reason I asked that is because there's so much happening here at Roswell. It's just kind of one blur. And I know you got a lot of things scheduled. When do you speak here?
I'm speaking on the Saturday, but yes, you're absolutely right about this. I mean, of course, I'm doing this interview. I've just done a TV interview. There are, I think, book signings and book reading sessions and my own presentation. And there'll doubtless be other things going on. I know, as you say, it's a whirl of activity, and there's always something going on. And the great thing about this is that there seem to be so many different strands to it. Now, I know there are one or two political issues about this, but there, I mean, three
UFO personal issues, but that's beside the point.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, just to come to a place and find that, well, they're not having a UFO conference; they're having three conferences.
All kinds of things are happening here, and as we tell our listeners all the time, Roswell is a great place to come anytime, especially in the fall and the spring. Little hot in the summer, but bad this year.
Yeah, it's nice, but yeah, the parade, of course.
Yes.
Jefferson Starship are playing a concert.
All kinds of things happening here. Now you're going to be over at the Pearson Auditorium on Saturday, and actually they're starting something new over there on Saturday, just before you speak or right after. I'm not quite sure. The Hall of Fame induction of Jesse Marcel. Jesse Marcel Jr., the son, will be taking that. I think that happens after his speaking engagement. So there's all kinds of things happening here.
Yes, absolutely. I think the town has, you know, obviously done a fine job in making the most of this and saying, look, people are genuinely interested in this. People are going to come here. Let's make sure there's a range of different things for them to do, get involved in. Yeah, it's great.
When we talk about your situation, former worker at—I guess you were at the Ministry of Defense, what years?
Well, I was working at the Ministry of Defense for 21 years. From 1985 through to 2006 when I resigned. But my time on the UFO project, of course, was only a small part of that 21-year career. That's a job I did between 1991 and 1994.
Now, did you want that job, or they just kind of dumped that in your lap?
It was a bizarre chain of circumstances. I had no previous knowledge about the UFO phenomenon, no prior interest or belief in the subject. But during the first Gulf War, I was working as a watchkeeper, a briefer, essentially, in the Air Force Operations Room in the Joint Operations Center in MOD main building. And the person to whom I was working most closely was quite impressed by the job that I was doing there. And he said, look, Nick, I know you're looking for a move, he said, after all this. He said, I've got a vacancy. Would you like the job? And I said, what's the job? And he said UFOs. And that's how it happened.
And what was the reaction of people who talked to you as a representative of the Ministry of Defense when you investigating UFOs, did they think it was unusual that somebody would actually be officially asking questions? I guess all kinds of reactions, really.
Yeah, the reactions were right across the board. Some people would effectively demonize the MOD, and I would find myself accused of being part of a cover-up, a disinformation agent, trying to elicit information from people when in fact we knew all about it anyway, etc., etc. Some people were reacting more positively. I mean, for example, just to give one a little illustration of this, one of the things that I did in my tour of duty was reach out to the UFO community and say, look, I know that we haven't really liaised significantly over the years, but I'm new in post. I'd like to make a fresh start, like to reach out to you, have meetings, exchange some information, maybe liaise. You can send us some cases. We'll see if we can release. This was prior to FOI, but we'll see if we can nonetheless release some of the older documents out of historical interest, that sort of thing. Interestingly, some of the UFO groups and organizations accepted this invitation willingly. Others were very suspicious, and it caused a lot of bad feeling, actually, between different parts of the UFO community.
So there's a little friction going on.
Oh, absolutely. But then that's the politics of ufology, and I guess you're always going to have that. But that's how I got...
How did it impact you personally? I mean, you obviously took it as an assignment that you needed to do your best work at. But what I am talking about, did you feel like you were kind of shoveled off to some place with UFOs, or did you consider that really a privilege to really get the government involved?
Well, the government had consistently been involved since the 50s. I mean, this wasn't a new post. The MOD, in some way, shape, or form, had been looking at the UFO issue consistently since the early 50s, and in relation to things like ghost rockets and Foo Fighters intermittently before that in the 40s. So, as I say, this wasn't new. As to my feelings on being given this job and as things unfolded, yeah, I of course did the best job I could of investigating, but yes, I genuinely became convinced that this was an interesting and important issue.
Yeah, I understand. We've met each other off and on and talked by phone as well over the years. You're very interested in this subject. You take it seriously. You're doing a lot of great work. Was it always that way? Were you always interested? Did you think there was something going on? That's what I was getting at.
No, for the early part.
Were you open to the subject, I guess?
I like to think that I was reasonably open-minded, but up in the first year and a half of my tour of duty, there were no particularly interesting cases. So I guess I was drifting along. I was investigating these. Most of them, of course, turned out to be misidentifications of something quite mundane. Then in March 1993, we had a very interesting case, which is now known as the Cosford incident. Second to Bentwaters, it's probably Britain's most compelling UFO incident. It was a case where, over a period of about 6 hours, many different people, some police, some military, saw a UFO, a large triangular-shaped craft moving slowly, then accelerating away rapidly. The sorts of UFO that has been seen, for example, in Hudson Valley, Belgium in 1989 and 1990, those sorts of things. Now, this was a case that was something of a watershed for me, because I think it was that case where I had an Air Force witness saying to me, look, Nick, this went from 30 or 40 miles an hour to speeds many times that of a jet aircraft in seconds, and I'm in the Air Force, he said, and I've been in the Air Force for 8 years, and I'm based at an Air Force establishment, and I see fast jets and military helicopters every day, and this is like nothing I have ever seen in my life. So yeah, that was a little bit of a turning point for me, and I made more of a point after that to do research in the archives to dig out some of the best older cases.
I had a reason for asking you that question. It might have seemed a little off the wall at first, but the reason is they are doing a lot of disclosure now, officially, right? What do you think these people that are involved in it now? I guess you know some of them involved in releasing this material. Are they, you think they're serious, or are they objective, or are they becoming convinced? In other words, I'm trying to find out what kind of reaction, if you work for, you know, a fairly high level in the United Kingdom government or any government, and they say, start releasing these cases, you think they were relieved to do that or not relieved?
I think the Ministry of Defense was somewhat forced into it. The French government releasing their UFO files in 2007 created a precedent that it was difficult for the MOD to ignore. The other point, which was, I think, the critical reason for this, was that the Ministry of Defense was getting more Freedom of Information Act requests on UFOs than any other single subject, including the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. Dealing with these on a case-by-case basis was proving administratively burdensome to the extent where they said, look, if we just declassify and release the whole lot and send them to the National Archives, most FOI requests we get in the future we can deal with a one-sentence response that says all the material is at the National Archives. Go in there for it.
I'm glad to hear that, because that seems logical, and I've often wondered why governments didn't do that. I mean, that would relieve them a lot of paperwork.
It would. I think the problem is that the Ministry of Defense and the DOD, any military and, to a lesser extent, governmental organization, these are inherently secretive organizations. When I joined the Ministry of Defense in 1985, Britain didn't even have a Freedom of Information Act. In fact, ours came into force. It was passed in 2000, didn't come fully into force for government departments and public bodies until 1st of January 2005. Think how recent that is. When I joined, the default position was that you said nothing, you released nothing. Material, if it was released, would come out 30 years after the event. And so you're dealing with organizations where the basic instinct is not to disclose.
Right, right. In other words, the air, if you're going to air on the side of just not telling anybody.
Absolutely. Not because you're evil, not because you're sinister and involved in some great cover-up, just because you're busy doing your job and dealing with public requests. Unless you have to respond to them because it's the law in relation to FOI, it's not a key priority for people.
So there is some reason for these laws to be passed. I mean, they do have an effect on the bureaucratic apparatus. If you have to do it, then it gets done.
Very much so. Now, of course, what we're seeing, it's almost like a domino effect, because the French government have released their files. The British government are in the process of revealing them. We've had three batches of files released. There are more to come. But also countries such as Brazil, Denmark, Canada, others have recently made some proactive releases. So every time a country does this, every time the information is put out there, I guess journalists and researchers and members of the public in other countries that have yet to do this say, okay, they've done it, what about us?
Mm-hmm. Good point. We're talking with Nick Pope. We'll be right back. We're here in Roswell. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away.
Go beyond the obvious and make Roswell, New Mexico, your brave new destination for fun and intrigue. Learn the truth about Roswell's history and see why Roswell's the mother of extraterrestrial connections. Whether you're looking for UFOs and aliens, cultural attractions, outdoor recreation, or even chewy mozzarella, there's plenty to uncover about this uncommon Roswell, New Mexico place. To find out more information on the mysteries of Roswell, visit www.roswellmysteries.com. Roswell, New Mexico. Visitors, welcome.
This is Jerry Pippin. We're broadcasting from Roswell. This is a 62nd anniversary. And, of course, Roswell really is growing. Each year we come back, we've been here 6 years now. When you come back, this town seems like it's reincarnated again each time, or recreated, or whatever the term you want to mention. It's still a nice, lovely place to visit. And so you might consider that, especially in the fall or the spring. I mean, the UFO Museum goes 24/7, but every day of the week. And there's other things to see as well. And one of the things to see this week would be at the Pearson Auditorium on Saturday. That right after Jesse Marcel, I think, does his induction for his father, and he makes a speech. I think there's also Grant Cameron will be there, and Nick Pope will be speaking that day.
Yes, I will. I'll be updating people because this is a subject I've spoken at UFO conferences before, but just what we've been talking about. I'm going to be speaking about the ongoing program to declassify and release the Ministry of Defense UFO files. I'm going to be talking about the background to that decision, the mechanics of the process, and of course I'm going to be dipping into the files themselves and highlighting some of the more interesting incidents to have come out. And I think I've got 1.5, maybe 2 hours, so I'm also going to take the opportunity, if time allows, to tell the audience about some of the other developments going on in British UFO research.
Well, I want to find out a little bit about that, if you don't mind. What other developments are happening?
One interesting change, although it has yet to have any discernible effect, was the move of the MOD's UFO project from Ministry of Defense headquarters building in Whitehall, London, to Headquarters Air Command at High Wycombe. Now, what this effectively did is it stripped the UFO project out of the command structure in which it had sat for several decades and put it in an operational Air Force command. Now, I felt that that might have an interesting and perhaps positive effect, because I thought that the military would be rather more vigorous and rigorous on this, would be a little less inclined than some of the civilian people who have been involved in this over the years, who, if they're not personally interested and convinced by this, have been a little too keen to deploy the rather negative no defense significance soundbite that the MOD uses to really just try and bat this subject away. Now, I felt that the military would be less likely to make assumptions and would say, well, go check and see if something was picked up on radar. Or if we've got a photo, take a look at it. Get the MOD's technical specialists to analyze and enhance the imagery. The sorts of things that I did on my tour of duty. Sadly, unless it's going on behind closed doors, this doesn't seem to have happened.
That happens many times. You know, you think that would be a logical progression, and for some reason it gets sidetracked or they just don't do it.
Yeah, I think it was an interesting story, and maybe it'll have an effect, but nothing so far. Another interesting development was that David Cameron was asked about the UFO issue. Now, David Cameron is the leader of the opposition in Britain. He leads the Conservative Party. Many people believe that he will be the next Prime Minister of Great Britain. Somebody at one of his public meetings managed to ask in the Q&A session a question about UFOs and said, if you become Prime Minister, what are you going to do about this issue and will you release all the information? Now, interestingly, he hadn't really been briefed on this, because I suppose the smart answer would have been, well, it's already happening. But maybe he didn't want to give the current government any credit for that. So he, for whatever reason, whether he didn't know or whether he wanted to make some political capital, said, well, I see no reason why this subject shouldn't be handled in an open and straightforward manner. And I see no reason why, if elected, I would want to keep any of this secret. So obviously this statement has been recorded, and it will come back to haunt him, absolutely. So again, that's another interesting development. Perhaps the development which was most newsworthy, and I think it's a story which did make the press even here in America as opposed to just the UK, was this story of a UFO allegedly colliding with a wind turbine. Now, this was...
It made the... In fact, Paula Schermerhorn, one of the people who works for me, she got very excited about that story for some reason. Go ahead.
Well, it was...
I guess it's an exciting story, really.
Yeah. Let me briefly tell the story.
Okay.
On, I think it was 7th of January this year, some of the local inhabitants of a small town called Conisholm in the county of Lincolnshire in England, saw some strange lights in the sky. Then at 4 in the morning the following day, a few of them were woken up by a loud crash, an explosion of some sort. The following morning when it was light, they went, and now there's a big wind farm there, and there are these massive wind turbines, which are
You may have seen some of those there everywhere.
Yes.
Coming down from Albuquerque. Yeah. It's nighttime. You probably didn't see much.
No. Well, these things are 265 feet tall, the ones in the UK I'm talking about. Each of the three blades are, I think, 66 feet
in length. Yeah, we've
seen
those things all around the world.
Yeah. So what happened when it got light, they found that one of the blades was still on and intact. One of them had been knocked completely off, and one of them was still on but was bent out of shape. Now, the suspicion was, people put it together, this chain of events, UFO sightings, a loud crash, the damage to the wind turbine. The suspicion in many people's minds was that something, and because we didn't know what it was, we used the phrase UFO, had collided with it. Now, what really made this story sensational was that in the UK, Britain's best-selling national daily newspaper, The Sun, decided to run with this story. Not only did they run it, they ran it as their main front-page headline.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the second time they've put a UFO story on the front page. This is Britain's best-selling paper. Second time a UFO story has been front-page main headline in The Sun in about 6 months, because last summer there was an incident of a UFO seen by some soldiers over a military base, and again that was run as the front page. And it shows, I mean, just digressing for a moment, but it shows how certainly in the UK, but I think one could point to the situation in the US as well, with Larry King, with some of the big ABC News, NBC News and Fox News shows, there has been a sea change in the way that the media are reporting this. I think we're seeing more coverage, and we're seeing more mainstream coverage, and dare I say, yes, of course, there are still some light-hearted articles and some articles that are, frankly, a little disparaging. But there are also some stories in the mainstream media that are playing this subject increasingly straight. And the wind turbine was one of those stories. Now, damaged material from the blade was taken back to the German manufacturers. They had a forensic analysis done. They said they no reason. It took them about a month to come up with. They said, we'll get you the results in about 2 or 3 days. It actually took a month. They said, we've found nothing anomalous here. So the story's slightly petered out, but it nonetheless was a major story in Britain and all around the world.
Took them a month to decide that they had the standard response.
Yes, and that was interesting. Another slightly interesting point was that The Sun ran some follow-up stories, and one of the follow-up stories related to people that they referred to as MOD insiders. Now, it wasn't me, but somebody had obviously spoken to them from MOD to suggest that a secret prototype UAV codenamed Taranis, designed by BAE Systems, a big defense contractor and designed for use in Afghanistan, that sort of operational theater, might have been responsible. Now, what was odd about this is normally, of course, anyone in the Ministry of Defense would bend over backwards to avoid any public speculation and debate about your next generation of military aircraft and UAVs, drones. So why on this occasion were they actively putting this up as a suggestion? Almost to try and kill a UFO story.
You were with them for a long time. Why were they?
No, I don't know. That one had me foxed.
I guess maybe that would be less of a crime than saying, yeah, it was a UFO.
Yeah, but it was genuinely very strange.
You brought something up with this story, Nick, that I run across all the time. And that's the cynicism of the public, and I'm sure it's there in England as well. I would imagine if I stopped 5 people on the street and asked them why is the media all of a sudden reporting UFOs with a straight face, probably 3 of those would say, well, the government's telling them to get us ready for something. You know, and my point is, it doesn't really work that way, or does it?
I don't think it does. I mean, I think if you look at the history of ufology, you'll know that we've been here before, that I can go back 10 years, we can probably go back a lot further and say various things, be they Hollywood movies, be they rumors about museum exhibitions and tours. But we've heard this concept before, that there's a program going on to acclimatize people, to prepare them for some great announcement, but that never seems to come to anything. No, I think that what we're seeing in Britain certainly is a change in the media's attitude, largely because of the declassification and release of the UFO files. And I've been peripherally involved, even though I'd left the MOD in 2006. The National Archives called me in early 2008, a few months before the release of the first batch, and they asked for my help with the process. And they said, look, can you do three different things? Help us, because you worked on these files, pick out some good cases. Some quirky ones, but some unexplained ones. Something so that they could interest the whole range of media. They also asked me to use my own media contacts, and I now work, among other things, as a freelance journalist and media commentator
right,
myself.
And we want to get to that before the end of the show. You have some interesting things going on.
Well, yeah, so they asked whether I could perhaps use my contact list to get this story out, and I was happy to do that. So I played a part in this, and my view was, let's use this to highlight whatever you believe about UFOs. Let's try and highlight cases where the witnesses are police officers, cases where there are perhaps near misses between UFOs and commercial airlines, cases where UFOs are tracked on radar. Let's highlight those sorts of cases. And because we were highlighting these sorts of cases, I think the media themselves, and through that the public, took a step back and said, hang on, we thought this was something that people saw, you know, on a lonely country road late at night. Now you're showing us the material from the government's files, and we've got near misses between these things and an aircraft, and we've got you saying in the file that this was backed up by radar evidence. Wait a minute. And journalists are belatedly, I think, realizing that there is a story here, and they're as interested in this, generally speaking, as people. So when the first batch of UFO files were released on May 14th, 2008, not only did the National Archives website record about 2 million hits within a matter of weeks, but the subject was carried in every single national daily newspaper in Britain, including the serious ones, who gave it absolutely straightforward, no-nonsense, factual reporting. None of this poking fun.
Have you noticed a difference in when reporters call you all the time because you worked with the Ministry of Defense? Is their attitude a little different these days when they call you? I mean, were they looking for trouble originally, or now they're looking for information?
I think that's true up to a certain point. I think any journalist now who's researched the subject will be doing so with the knowledge that there is a massive archive of government material out there which can back up the sorts of things that I'm talking about, whereas previously they had to take it on my say-so. But now I say to them, well, and here's the document where you've got this pilot talking about this case, and here's the document where you've got the radar evidence. So I'm in a position of much greater strength when any journalist comes to me that's already looked into this before they call. But generally speaking, I've never been really the victim of any setup with the media, because people know that I worked in government for 21 years, so they know that they're getting someone who did this, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but I'm just in a strict media way. Yeah, this wasn't my hobby, this was my job. Mm-hmm. So they come to me with that in mind.
So when we talk about the media, and now you're a member of the media, really, just like
yes.
me.
Yes.
I find the influence on members of the media, whether you're a television reporter for NBC or the BBC, or you get your own talk show, or you're just a cub reporter starting down here at the local newspaper, the influence is not really from the government as much as it is peers, your reaction of the people you work with. And you might go into that newsroom thinking, hey, I got a great UFO story, and everybody's made fun of you 30 years ago, so you write it from a chuckle standpoint. Now people are beginning to come around, and maybe they're a little more open. I think that has a big influence, more than the government calling up and saying, don't report that or we'll put you in Guantanamo or someplace.
Yes, and I don't believe, certainly speaking from personal experience, that the government in Britain has ever done that.
It's never happened to me.
Well, and in Britain, I'll give you a practical example. Yes, the Ministry of Defence, through the press office, will continually try to downplay the subject. And sometimes it will use a few little dirty tricks, just by, for example, using phrases like little green men and referring to the UFO research community as UFO spotters or something a little disparaging to try and perhaps influence a story to make sure that it's you know, not something that's going to be looking in huge detail at issues of what's in our airspace, but it's going to be a little bit more of a silly season story. Having said that, I think it is changing. And I mean, yeah, to give you a practical example, I write as a freelance journalist for a number of newspapers and magazines. I commentate on UFOs, but also on the unexplained and on some other subjects on a lot of TV shows. As a journalist, of course, I'd be the first to admit that I tailor my own performance, my own product, to the audience for which I'm writing and speaking. And when I go on a light-hearted morning chat show and do a piece there where I'm sitting around with the presenter on the sofas, and it's one of these programs that's watched mid-morning by a lot of people who, you do a fairly light-hearted, chatty show. When I'm on an evening news show, I will perhaps, play it in a different way. The best example, I guess, though, is when I'm writing. When I'm writing for example, as I have written an op-ed for the New York Times, I wrote that op-ed in a very straightforward, almost dry manner. Yes, highlighting some interesting cases, but playing it very much as a defense, national security, and air safety issue, which is my great mantra and why I'm still involved in this. When I write, as I do for newspapers like The Sun, which are far more populist in their approach, yes, we'll get into some slightly more dramatic and populist language, but that's the nature of the beast.
How did that article come around for you to do the New York Times? And that's they're pretty conservative as far as UFO issues, things like that. The air safety issue, I guess, was the handle to get in the door.
Yes, what happened was that the New York Times spoke to me before the file release and then ran an article on it, but didn't use my quote and went with quotes from the UFO research community. So Leslie Kane, the investigative journalist, called me up and said, well, Nick, why don't you build on that article and write an op-ed for them? Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, I'll pitch something. Now, it was quite a long process. I had to say what I was proposing. We went back and forward with a few calls and emails so that they could get a sense.
But no one at the New York Times said, I don't want to do any UFO stuff.
No. When I approached them, they said, well, that's interesting. Tell us what your angle is. Uh-huh. And it was defense, potential espionage as well. I said, look, post 9/11 particularly, we should be absolutely certain about anything in American airspace, shouldn't we? And if there's something which is being labeled as a UFO, but people aren't looking at it because filter programs are running on radar systems and air traffic controllers and fighter controllers aren't even looking at this, or if people are using their prejudices about the term UFO and we're not looking at something in American airspace, I said, post 9/11, isn't that a serious issue? They rather liked that angle because it wasn't, I think, the traditional angle in a UFO story. So they said, yeah, let us have it. So I wrote it. It went into the system. 2 or 3 months passed. I thought, well, maybe they'll use it, maybe they won't. I suddenly got a call and had to do a very quick couple of revisions, do the final fact check, sign it off, and then it ran. And a lot of people were absolutely incredulous that the New York had, the New York Times had run an op-ed, and that it, I don't want to sound boastful, but that it had taken a Brit to get it in.
Well, I think it was, you know, one of those door-opening movements. I mean, I think that they've now done it, so...
When I saw it in print in the New York Times, I normally, with my journalistic work, by the time something that I've written is published, I've moved on to the next thing, and I've got tapes of me on TV, which I've never even bothered to watch, because, you know, as a journalist, that's stuff I've done, and I'm always thinking about what the next project is. But this was one piece of work that stands up with a few others. I was really proud of this, and the response that it generated from readers, but not just that, but on the radio shows, on the blogs, the forums, the email discussion lists, was absolutely phenomenal. I mean, in terms of the reaction, and some people saying, this is fantastic, this is great. Some people saying, no, this is crazy. Others saying, what's going on? Why is the Times looking at this and even doing it?
Gets back to my conspiracy theory. 3 out of 5 think there's something working, and they're not necessarily. when we talk to Nick Pope, we have to find out what he's up to. He's got a company that does quite a few multimedia things. You're into television pretty good.
I'm doing a lot of television work. That's probably the main focus of activity at the moment. Obviously, I was involved quite heavily with some of the episodes of UFO Hunters. I've also been involved with a new History Channel show called That's Impossible, which is going to look at various fringe science, cutting-edge technologies, and nothing to do, or only peripherally to do, perhaps some people would say, with UFOs, but in my capacity as someone who comments as a defense analyst from time to time because of my background, I'm commenting on, and this is a 6-part series that starts on July 7th, I believe, on History Channel. It's going to look at things like invisibility, mind control, robotics, weather weapons, nanotechnology, eugenics, that sort of thing. So that's an interesting area that I've been involved with. And several new UFO shows, both proposed series and potential one-off documentaries that I'm involved in pitching and filming show reels for. So watch this space.
You
or rather listen to it.
Yes, radio or whatever. Nick Pope, it's always a joy seeing you. You come to the States quite often these days.
Yes, I was looking on my way over actually at my passport, and it's a comparatively new passport. I renewed it, I think, in 2007. I've already got about 7 or 8 U.S. stamps in there. I was over for Steve Bassett's X conference earlier this year.
Here, you know, you're talking about Steve. He's got a good idea of hitting, I think, and I'll run this by you and see what your reaction is. You have a similar background. He is urging everybody to write the White House press group, not officially, just the organization itself, to ask questions about UFOs. And I think if we can get reporters asking enough questions, that'll probably happen. I mean, probably faster than the government deciding to do something.
Yes, I think any pressure that's bottom-up, whether it's from the public, whether it's from the media, but particularly, obviously, the government's going to pay even more attention, I think, to the media, than the public, particularly if people are putting them on the spot, then, yeah, I'm not sure that this campaign is going to succeed or not, because I think it
Well, it
depends.
Probably won't, but it might open the door a little.
Yeah.
And somebody might say, hey, Helen Thomas kind of got barred for asking questions like that, but somebody might do it again.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see how that unfolds. But yeah, I'm a frequent visitor for these conferences. I love coming to America, and I hope that I'll continue coming to these conferences for a long time. I think they're very interesting. Obviously, new information is presented, but also as somebody who's involved in this field, it's an interesting opportunity for me to catch up with some old friends and to network on all the latest developments in this fascinating subject.
Nick Pope, thanks for being on with us, and they can see some of your work on the History Channel soon.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much. It's been great to be on the show again.
Okay, this is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from Roswell, and we'll be right back. It's the 62nd anniversary of the Roswell crash. Don't go away.